Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 17th Annual Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration takes place tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Temple Israel. This year, the focus is on the estimated 5 million non-Jews who perished alongside the 6 million Jews murdered during the Holocaust. The groups included everyone from Germans with physical and mental disabilities, Poles and other Slavic peoples, homosexuals, people of African and Asian descent, ideological enemies of the Third Reich, and the Romani, or Gypsies. The guest for this year's commemoration has focused her work on the plight of the Romani. Dr. Nadine Blummer has just finished a residency at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and is starting a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Ethnographic Research and Exhibition in the Aftermath of Violence at Concordia University in Montreal. Blummer will be speaking on Forgotten Holocaust Victims, How Germany Remembers the Roma. My guest today is the recently named director of the Council for Holocaust Education at the Jewish Community Center, Susie Bogle. She joins us to talk about the commemoration along with her plans for the organization as she takes over for a great legend in our community, Eva Unterman. Susie Bogle is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Susie Bogle, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And you are the recently named Director of Holocaust Education for the Jewish Federation of Tulsa, and you're following in some very large footsteps in Eva Unterman, who really opened a lot of people's eyes around here to the story of the Holocaust, and it's really become a major commemoration each year thanks to her efforts. How did you get into this?
That's a good question. Eva was my inspiration. But my connection to it goes back quite a long way to my childhood. I am not Jewish, and none of my family perished in the Holocaust, so it's not personal on that level. However, I moved to England when I was three, and my parents divorced, and my mother stayed there and married a Brit. And his parents, my step-grandparents, had fought the war. And so when we were living there, it was only 30 years since the end of the war. So the memory was fairly fresh, especially among the generation who had fought the war. My English grandmother was in the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, or the WAF, as she calls it. And my stepfather's father had been in the Royal Air Force, and he'd been in the Danbuster Squadron as an aerial photographer. And their son, my uncle, was a historian at the Imperial War Museum. So when I was growing up,
you spent a lot of time at that museum.
Yes, I did. And this history was very sort of much part of the cultural narrative of my upbringing. So, for example, the house that we lived in was built in 1907, but the house across the street was built in the 50s. And when we would do gardening in the front garden, we would frequently find pieces of shrapnel because the house across the street had been bombed, or the row of houses, which is why the houses looked different. All the windows, for example, in the front of my house were relatively new, but in the back of my house, they were old because they had all been destroyed in the bombing during the Battle of Britain. So this was something that I was aware of the war as a child. My grandparents had friends who had married Jews, one particularly who had married a Czech Jew. I knew he had escaped. I don't remember ever learning this in school, but this is something that I sort of grew up being aware of. I was aware that he needed to escape. I just had this as part of my upbringing.
So when did it morph into a study of the issues surrounding the Holocaust?
Well, when I decided to become a teacher, I was teaching adults at TCC. And one of the periods of history that I taught was World War II and the Holocaust. And I was very surprised to see so many students who had passed through our school system that really didn't have any idea that there was a Holocaust, didn't know really that the war had started before 1941. And I decided that I wanted to make sure that this was not going to be the case once they left my classroom. So I investigated what resources were available in Tulsa.
And of course,
I found
that was
Eva. And luckily, I had also heard her speak because she had spoken to my son's class, and I had gone as an interested parent and been extremely affected by her. And as a result of teaching this history, I was able to go on a three-week training tour for teachers to Germany, Poland, and the Czech Republic. And we went to eight different concentration camps, and I learned more about this history probably than I would have ever done by reading a book. So I've worked very closely with Eva as a teacher, and then, of course, that's kind of what led me to working closely with her as the director of Holocaust education.
Now, you're taking over some very large shoes here in the case of Eva.
Yes.
And really, you can talk about what she's done for this community as far as Holocaust education.
Absolutely. Our state does not mandate this teaching. And Eva really has been the driving force behind students in Tulsa learning about this history. There's a very committed group of teachers that she has cultivated in our schools, and she has empowered to teach this history by providing them with resources, by orchestrating opportunities for their students to express what they have learned through writing, through art. And for the last 17 years, Eva has spearheaded the annual Tulsa Interfaith Commemoration of the Holocaust, which is known in the Jewish community as Yom HaShoah, which means the Day of the Shoah or the Day of the Holocaust. And this commemoration is pivotal to what the students learn. For example, our committed teachers bring their students. They bring their students' artwork. And this is really sort of the culminating part of their study for the year because it occurs in late April or May every year.
Now, I was struck by something you said. You said, you know, the state does not mandate that we teach the Holocaust. Why is it important to teach the Holocaust here in the middle of Oklahoma? I mean, I can see some people saying, well, you know, this happened a continent away. There are genocides everywhere. Why this particular one? Is there a good answer for that?
Well, this particular one was unprecedented in the history of the world. This was the state-sponsored mass murder on an industrial scale of citizens by their own government. And this was a 20th century first world democratically elected government. So in that respect, I think it's a significant world event, a defining event in world history. And certainly the circumstances which led to it exist here in Oklahoma. There is a great deal of prejudice still in Oklahoma. For example, there is a need for a security system at the Jewish Federation. You know, before I go to work every day, I have to be buzzed into the building because there are people who still harbor hatred towards others that are different from them.
I think what I was getting at is, you know, the main reason for this education is, yes, we want to remember what happened in this incident, but there's a larger lesson of the persecution of the other.
Yes, and we saw an example of that a few weeks ago in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, this is not new. And it's around us all the time, whether we are aware of it or not.
Well, what's going to happen for this year's Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration? This is the first one you're sort of in charge of, although
yes.
I'm sure Eva's adding some help.
Absolutely. This year. We are working side by side together. She has so much knowledge of this history personally and so much experience of the teaching of it. I'm just trying to learn as much as I can from her. Our commemoration this year will focus on the non-Jewish victims of the Holocaust. This is the first time that we have had a theme of this kind because as a Jewish organization, our focus has been historically the Jewish experience of the Holocaust, which is very well known in our popular culture through things like Schindler's List and Frank's Diary. But many people don't know that of the 11 million people that were murdered by the Nazis, 5 million of them were not Jewish. So this commemoration is focusing on those victims and drawing attention to the fact that this is not just an exclusively Jewish experience.
And those others included?
They included a large number of Roma and Sinti, commonly referred to as gypsies, and our speaker will specifically address that topic. They were persecuted under the same circumstances as the Jews in terms that they were targeted for ethnic reasons. And there were also a large number of non-Jewish Polish people that were murdered. There were Jehovah's Witnesses murdered, homosexuals, people who were intellectual. The Polish intelligentsia was almost completely wiped out. Anyone who presented a threat to Nazi ideology was targeted.
Disabled German children.
Yes.
Intellectually challenged children.
Yes. This
anyone with disabilities.
Exactly. This is a very, very significant part of it. This is actually where the Nazis practiced their mass killing on a huge scale. So, for example, the very first targets of mass gassings were disabled children, mentally and physically. And these children were rounded up by their doctors, by nurses, by teachers, and they were sent to institutions. If they were not already in an institution, they were sent to one. And this is really where the final solution, which ended up being exercised against the Jews and the Roma, really sort of came into being in terms of them understanding the mechanics of it. So the disabled population of Germany and of German-occupied Europe was a very disturbing first step in what would eventually become the genocide of the Jews.
Now, tell us about your guest that's coming in.
Our guest is Dr. Nadine Blummer, and she is coming to us from, she has a long background in research on the Roma. Her specific specialty is how Germany remembers the Roma. She's doing postdoctoral research right now. She's just come back from Berlin, and she's a sociologist as opposed to a historian. She's always careful to tell me that. But her specialty really is how Germany has altered their perception of the Romani genocide and what that has meant for the Romani people. So, for example, in 2012, Germany opened the very first Holocaust memorial to the Roma and Sinti victims of Nazi persecution. This was very significant and has sort of altered the perception of that part of the Holocaust in Germany and elsewhere.
And that was, they were the forgotten population from the Holocaust for an awful long time. In fact, there's still an awful lot of persecution against the Romani today.
Absolutely, yeah. The largest ethnic minority in
Europe. So how did Germany view the Romani after the war? Was it just not thought about? What exactly?
No, well, I see a lot of Germany had, a lot of Europe had sort of subjugated this population already at the beginning. And for various different reasons, one of them is that they had decided that they were a criminal element. So in the concentration camps, sometimes the Roma and Sinti would have to wear the badge of a criminal because they did not live like other Europeans lived. Some of them did, and some of them didn't. But there was a large number of them that were itinerant, so they would move around, and this caused suspicion amongst Europeans. They looked different. They spoke a different language. They had different customs.
And this is a time when borders were not transparent as they are today in the European. In the European Union.
Right. So there's this whole idea of these people are different. They're strange. They're not like us. And so afterwards, there was this sort of idea that, well, they were persecuted because many of them are criminals. And you don't really need to compensate criminals because for the same, the homosexuals experienced the same thing. They were sent to prison because they had broken a law, the Penal Code paragraph 175. So there's this idea that if you have imprisoned someone because they have broken some laws, you don't therefore need to compensate them for wrongdoing against them.
Mm-hmm.
It's very complicated politically.
It is, and it still remains complicated.
It does.
Even today, there's issues of mass deportations in many Romani communities in Western Europe. Nothing has changed a whole lot about that.
Right.
You mentioned earlier that in the final solution, you mentioned Jews, it was geared towards the Jews. Did it also mention the Romani as well?
They were definitely killed like the Jews. So they were targeted for the same reason, and they were ethnically undesirable according to the German racial
purity codes.
Purity, exactly.
Uh-huh. Codes, uh-huh.
Exactly. So they were subjected to mass gassings and deportations, imprisonment, just like the Jews. There were whole camps. For example, at Auschwitz, there was the Gypsy family camp, of which very few people survived.
My guest today is Susie Bogle, the new director of Holocaust education for the Jewish Federation of Tulsa. She'll be, along with Ava Unterman, who's a long time worked in Holocaust education in our community, will be hosting the 2014 Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration. That takes place Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at Temple Israel. This year, remembering the forgotten victims of the Holocaust. And the guest will be Dr. Nadine Blummer, who is specialized in the story of the Romani, or gypsies, if you will, in the Holocaust. What will happen at the actual commemoration? Give us a sense of, I know that there's like artwork on display. Yes. Give us a sense of what will actually occur at the commemoration.
Well, we will begin with a welcome and introduction by Jacob Howland, who is a professor of
philosophy
here at TU. And he is also on our council. So he will sort of give an overview and place the what the speaker is going to say in context. For example, allow people to sort of get an idea of who these non-Jewish victims were. Then Dr. Blummer will give us an overview of her recent experience studying in Germany, and also how Germany is remembering the Roma relates to how Germany remembers the Jewish Holocaust. And then we will also have some musical selections from a piece called The Holocaust Cantata, Songs from the Camps. And there are two pieces. One is an a cappella quartet, and that's called The Striped Ones, which is a very moving piece. And another one is called Tempo di Tango, and it is a duet between cello and piano. Then we'll have a candle lighting ceremony of people from our community who are representing those non-Jewish victims and also the Jewish victims. And then we will have the memorial prayer that is sung by our cantor. And the student artwork will be on display for anyone who wants to go and look at it.
Now, how many students do you reach in the course of a year leading up to this commemoration?
Well, it depends if you're speaking about those that are studying in the classroom or those that just come to our museum.
Well, both.
Well, for example, through the Any Given Child program, all seventh graders in Tulsa Public Schools this year came through our museum. So there are a very large number just of seventh graders, just in Tulsa Public Schools. That doesn't even count the students that come from different districts. So there's all of those. Plus, recently we hosted the White Rose Essay Contest, and we had 476 essays from schools in and around Tulsa. So there's almost 500 students who have processed this history to the extent that they have really thought about it and written about it in detail. Then we will have probably, I would say, over 100 pieces of art by some of those same students who wrote the White Rose essay, but some different ones. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot. I couldn't put an exact number on it, but there are a lot of students that
you mentioned the seventh graders in the Tulsa system coming through mm-hmm. Any Given Child. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a major area of focus, I would think, in the coming years as that program continues.
Yes, absolutely, and it's been renewed for next year also. So we have the opportunity to reach a whole new group of seventh graders and a whole new group of teachers, because not all of them stay with their students. So it's our responsibility to provide those teachers with as many resources as possible, not just when they come on the field trip, but also in the classroom. Even if it's not going out into the schools anymore to speak, but there are a lot of testimonies by survivors available electronically now. So there's a lot of resources that we can put into the hands of these teachers that can really deliver this history in a way that is relevant to this generation.
Mm. So where do you see the organization going as far as Holocaust education in the transition? And mm-hmm. What would you like to see as this effort continues?
What I would ultimately like to see is that our state would mandate this teaching. So that's my ultimate goal. Because that will basically ensure for posterity that this history is not going to be forgotten here in Oklahoma.
And hopefully prevent it from happening again. I think that's the broader issue, that the persecution of the other is always with us.
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen it here in our own history, with, mm-hmm. with our history with Native Americans. This is not exclusive. This kind of cruelty is not exclusively something that the Nazis invented. I mean, obviously, that was on an unprecedented scale. But they built on prejudice and hatred that already existed. If it hadn't existed in the first place, they wouldn't have been able to leverage so much support. I think that the greater goal for this teaching is obviously to empower students and young people to speak up when they see injustice, not just to sort of stand by, but to stand up. So the cultivation of an upstander community within Tulsa, in our schools, I think is essential. This history is a wonderful tool to be able to do that. I would love to be able to reach more teachers through social media. I'd like to sort of take what we're doing and move it and leverage technology to really reach more people and more students in a way that they find relevant today.
Mm-hmm. Now, with Ava stepping down, this was, she had firsthand knowledge, you know,
she did.
Mm-hmm. How does this change from being sort of a first person mm-hmm. witness to a third person documenter or mm-hmm. chronicler or teller?
That's a great question. And we're still figuring that out. The world is still figuring that out. In fact, Eva and I are going to be attending a conference in Israel this summer that whose specific goal is the, really the articulation of how do we do this now? Now that this is no longer history that is spoken about by eyewitnesses, and it will become history that is that we no longer have eyewitnesses for eventually. How do we do this? And I think one of the really wonderful ways that we have is that we have their stories recorded. So many of them through the Shoah Foundation have been able to record their stories, and this generation is a very visual generation. So seeing that will be very powerful. It will never be the same as hearing it from someone who was there. But I would like to encourage teachers to focus on those individual stories as opposed to numbers. This is what I was taught when I was trained in how to teach this history. You focus on an individual. That's why the story of Anne Frank is so powerful, because as you read her diary, you get to know her. So I would really, really like to encourage teachers to focus on not just Eva's story, but have students find a story through any of the numerous memoirs that are available through the Shoah Foundation recordings.
Through the Holocaust Museums, yeah.
Through the Holocaust Museum.
You do that when you go to the Holocaust Museum. You follow a person.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, when you go to the one in D.C., they'll give you a passport, someone's passport and someone's name, right? So I think the key to it is to make it personal, to always remember that these were people with families, with lives, just like us. These are not just sort of numberless people who lived in this black and white world.
Yeah, 6 million is a pretty abstract number.
It is. So is 11 when you talk about all of them. It is. And I think when we focus on numbers, we sort of take away the humanity of it. But when I would say to my students, pick an individual, study that individual, and tell the rest of the group about that individual, the students really felt this very strong connection and responsibility towards that individual. Like, my responsibility is to tell their story, even if it's just in on a Thursday morning in class. Mm. Once you get that connection, I think the humanity of it is something that they can then take into the rest of their life and hopefully remind them, ideally in their everyday dealings with other people.
Mm. Well, we wish you great success with Holocaust education here in our community. Susan Bogle, thanks very much for joining us. The 2014 Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration takes place tomorrow night at Temple Israel, remembering all of the victims of the Holocaust this year. Susie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Susie Bogle is the director of the Council for Holocaust Education at the Jewish Community Center. The 17th Annual Interfaith Holocaust Commemoration takes place tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Temple Israel, featuring Dr. Nadine Blummer speaking on Forgotten Holocaust Victims, How Germany Remembers the Roma. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
The title of this story is Little Did I Know. Well, that could be the title of the story of my life, but for now, it's the title of how I met the internationally famous mathematician Martin Gardner. I didn't meet internationally famous mathematician Martin Gardner in person, but I did meet him by phone, and it was memorable, and here's how it happened. I discovered that he was the author of one of my favorite books titled The Annotated Alice, about the Lewis Carroll stories, and that he was born in Tulsa in 1914, and at the time he was living in Norman. So I called him to interview him for an article about Alice in Wonderland and Alice through the Looking Glass. He was charming. The Annotated Alice, I found out, was his most profitable book. But little did I know at the time that he was also the author of more than 100 books about recreational mathematics and puzzles. He also wrote about L. Frank Baum, the author of the Wizard of Oz books, and he founded the International Wizard of Oz Club. Mr. Gardner was particularly famous for his column in Scientific American. He was also admired for his skill and knowledge of magic, and he wrote books about the magic trade. Little did I know. When he died in 2010, the magician Penn of the magician duo Penn and Teller wrote a valentine of an obituary of him for the New York Times. Well, last year, Mr. Gardner's posthumous, chatty, and informal memoir was published with the wonderful title, Undiluted Hocus Pocus. What I love most about this book is what he has to say about growing up in Tulsa. The book begins this way. I have always loved colors, all colors. To me, the ability to see colors is one of God's greatest blessings. Well, that love may be traced to his mother, who was a painter who studied with Ada Robinson at the University of Tulsa. An oil portrait of his mother by Miss Robinson is owned by Gilchrist Museum. Ada Robinson was also the designer of Boston Avenue Church, where the Gardner family attended. The Gardners first lived in a small house with an outdoor pump in North Tulsa, but after his father's oil company made big money, they moved south, and their final home still stands at 2187 South Owosso. He was a student at Lee Elementary School and then Horace Mann Junior High and finally Central High School, which he hated. He said high school was like 4 years in prison. The only classes he liked were mathematics and physics. He particularly disliked history classes, and he believed the history of science was more important than anything any king or queen or religious leader ever did. Mr. Gardner later dedicated some of his books to his geometry class teacher and to his physics class teacher. His passions in high school were chess and magic. When I interviewed him, he said that what he liked about the Alice in Wonderland books were the puzzles and chess game woven into the story. After he was graduated from the University of Chicago, he came home to Tulsa for a while and worked for the oil editor at the Tulsa Tribune for $15 a week. After about a year, editor Jenkin Lloyd Jones fired him, and he went back to Chicago and on to greater things. Now, April is always designated as Math Awareness Month, and this year, Martin Gardner is being honored. The theme is Mathematics, Magic, and Mystery. What fun to know that I can walk past the same Tulsa places where Mr. Gardner lived and learned and studied and started. When he died, praise for him flooded the media. A British mathematician said he brought more mathematics to more millions than anyone else. And Pulitzer Prize winner Richard Hofstadter said that Martin Gardner was one of the greatest American intellects of the 20th century. Oh, little did I know.
Connie Cronley is the executive director of the Iron Gate Ministry, a writer and essayist, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, you can listen online on demand at any time at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa. You can look at our most recent episodes and search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.